So today we start to discuss the issue and the, you know, the treatment of renormalization theory in perturbation theory, in quantum field theory. So today and tomorrow, well, I hope I will have finished to discuss that, I'm going to discuss renormalization at one loop order and for the 5-4 theory, on the example of the 5-4 theory that we have discussed. I think you have heard already about renormalization in QFT1, maybe, a bit. And so it was, I presume, on the example of QED, but you'll see the connection. And next week, I'm going to devote at least one and maybe two lectures to renormalization theory from the point of view of Wilson, namely in real space, which has been formulated for statistical mechanics and quantum and condensed matter problems, but which is deeply connected, which is in fact another way to look at the property of renormalization and renormalizability in quantum field theory. So I hope to be able to do that in a reasonable amount of time. But Wilson's theory of renormalization theory, I think you have seen already that a bit in statistical mechanical course. So I'm trying to make the connection between the two. Okay, so I'm going to treat for the 5-4 theory. I'm going mostly to discuss the case of the massless theory, and we are going to see what it means exactly, precisely, to have a theory which is massless. And in addition, I'm going to discuss essentially the case where the space, the dimension of space-time is 4, because that's the point where the issue is very important. Okay, so first, let me back to remind you the 2 and 4 point functions in 5-4 and the fact that they are short distance ultraviolet divergences. So we have discussed that very briefly. So let me remind you, if you consider the irreducible functions, which, as we have seen, are the building blocks for constructing, you know, the Green, the correlation function, and therefore the amplitudes for the theory. And they are given by, for the two-point function, they are given by this diagram in the 5-4 theory. So these are amputated legs. So they are given by this, basically, this diagram that is called the tadpole diagram, because it looks like a tad with the two little legs. I think that's generic. And which means that, in fact, that's a one-loop diagram. It means that the two-point function, so let me, we have seen that the two-point function, as a function of, let me express it in terms of momentum. So I'm considering the Fourier transform in momentum space. So this is just the Fourier transform of the irreducible two-point function in real space that I discussed yesterday. So there is a delta function which enforces the conservation of momenta. And then there is an interesting part, which is non-trivial part, which is, so let's make it P1. Okay, I'm going to consider the same notation, but this is just a function of one variable, and this is a function of two variables. So maybe in the lecture there was a tilde or something like that. Okay, where this gamma, the irreducible two-point function, expressed as a function. Well, let me just write it with a tilde. Okay. So this is p squared plus m squared, if we, and then minus g over 2 times this diagram, the amplitude of this diagram, And so the amplitude of this diagram, so the amplitude associated to this diagram, of course, it doesn't depend on the momenta, but it's given by integral d dk over 2 pi to the power d, 1 over k squared plus m squared, where k is the internal momentum inside the loop. K is momentum. Inside the loop, okay? And of course, I start from a theory whose action is 1/2 of d phi squared. This is a kinetic term, this is a mass term, and this is the interaction term. Okay, so this is a coupling constant, it's a g, not a two. This is the symmetry factor of the graph, and that's just a number. So you see, it's a function of the mass. So let me call it T of M, because it's the tadpole, the tadpole amplitudes. And for the four-point function, so this is a two-point function, the four-point function, again, now it's a function of four momenta. There is this delta function conservation momenta plus p2 plus p4. And these are, of course, d component momenta in momentum space. So those are vectors. Then I have the similar function, magnitude of Pu, and it depends only. Well, let me just denote that that depends on three independent momenta. Okay, and this function is 4, it depends. And so this 4-point function is given by this graph, amputated graph, which doesn't depend on the momenta. So this is just the coupling constant. So these are the truncated momenta. And then we have a G divided by 2 times the amplitude associated to this diagram, plus with 1, 2, 3, 4, plus two other terms obtained by making permutation of the indices. So this is irreducible amputated two-point function, where here is the momentum P incoming, and here the incoming momentum here is minus P. And this is the irreducible four-point function with amputated external legs, where the momenta here are P1, P2, P3, P4, with this conservation of momenta rule. Okay. So this is two-point function, this is a four-point function. Okay. At one loop, of course, then you have the higher order diagrams. Okay. And now we can start to do some physics. And there is something that you probably know already, but that I have not discussed that yet. So one side remark. One property, that's one important property of the effective action, is that in momentum space, that's a general property. I'm going to express it in momentum space. There is a simple relation between the irreducible two-point function and the connected correlation function. So let me call the connected correlation function, and let me call it, I don't remember how it's called in my notes, G. So G of P is just the full sum over all connected diagrams and in momentum space, I have an incoming momentum here and an incoming momentum minus P here, okay? So it's just a Fourier transform of the connected correlation function of the field in real space, okay? So we have this object and we have this gamma, well, of course, let me add a subscript 2 to remember that's a two-point function, and we have this object. So irreducible function, gamma 2 of P, which is the same quantity, but with truncated, you know, amputated legs, and the irreducible function. Okay, so we have two functions of P, and there is a simple relation which is general. So it's valid when you include all the diagrams, so at all loops. It's simply that G2 in momentum space is just 1 over gamma 2 in momentum space. So that's just the inverse. And, well, you can show this relation by using the functional definition of the effective action, the relation between the effective action and the generating function for the connected function, which is W, remember? So you can, that's a property. This comes from Legendre transform property. But in a quantum field theory, there is a simple diagrammatic derivation of this, because simply, let's note here that, for instance, that this diagram is you know, this is just the first one-loop diagram of a list of all possible irreducible two-point diagrams. So you can write that this gamma 2 can be written as the amputated propagator plus something that I'm going to call sigma, which is a sum contribution of irreducible diagram graphs, Feynman diagrams, with B larger or equal to one loops. Remember, we defined this concept of loops. So this is the first diagram. Okay. And if you think about the diagrammatic of G2 of P, G2 of P is just, you know, you consider all connected diagrams, but all connected diagrams can be constructed in phi to the 4 out of chains of irreducible diagrams. So you can write this as is connected. This is just, first this is a propagator. Then there is one sigma, then there is two sigma, etc. Okay? And, of course, then I made a mistake that you should have been corrected when we computed that yesterday. There is a plus sign here because the sign of a contribution of diagram is minus the number of vertices times Well, there is one minus per vertex and one global minus, because there is this relation in the Legendre transform between gamma, which is minus W plus something. So here there is a plus, while here there is a minus. So, and in fact, if you are careful, there is a minus sign here, because the two-point function is 1 over p squared plus m squared minus g over 2. So there is a minus sign here, and there is a plus sign here, and that's important. And so, let me just insist on that. Here it's a minus. No, here it's a minus. Here it's a plus because I went too fast. Here is a plus. If you have two chains, then you have a minus the chain of 3. Etc. And so in momentum space, this is 1 over p squared plus m squared. This is minus 1 over p squared plus m squared squared times sigma. So this function sigma, this gives a function of p. So you can write that gamma 2 is p squared plus m squared plus some function of p. It's a function of p and of the mass, some function. While g2 of p is 1 over p squared plus m squared minus minus 1 over p squared plus m squared squared times sigma of p plus sigma of p squared times p squared plus m squared, well, divided to the power of 3 plus etc. And this is a geometric series, which amounts to the inverse of this. So by walking in momentum space, looking at the Feynman diagrams, make this relation easy to understand. Yes?
Could you explain those minuses again?
What?
Could you explain the minus sign again? Like, does sigma, yeah? Sigma include the minus g to the power of whatever.
Right. The minus signs come from the fact that the effective action in a field is g times phi minus w of g. And if you work out the diagrammatic and the relation between g and phi, remember, in this relation, phi is delta W over delta G. Otherwise, this is the sum of all those connected diagrams where you have isolated one G, so one source term here. And reciprocally, G is delta W over delta phi. So it's a sum over all possible irreducible diagram with one amputated legs isolated, and we associate a phi, you see? And if you see what this corresponds in terms of Feynman diagrams here, g phi means that you take a connected diagram and you associate. Well, if you work out, so it means that here you have arbitrary number of g here, and here you have an arbitrary number of isolated, of amputated legs with some phi. So you remove one phi to compute g of phi. You see? You take the irreducible function, you pick up one leg at random, and you remove the phi. And you consider the dependence of this object when you have removed one phi. See? This is G. And reciprocally, phi is you take all the connected diagrams with G attached to the external legs. You take one, you remove the G, the remaining function of G is phi. And now, if you work out this relation, for instance, here, W is given by the sum over connected diagrams. In this expression, G is G and phi is also given by a sum over connected diagram. But when you compute this expression and re-express things in terms of phi using this relation, it turns out that you get only the irreducible diagram involving phi. I can try to make that by just on the blackboard, but I fear I can make a mistake, but maybe not. Because W of G in this relation, W of G, okay. But the point is that there is a minus sign here. And so W involves those diagrams with a minus sign. And you, when you work out using this relation, gamma involves some diagrams minus this one. So this diagram, this particular diagram, appears with a plus. And when you work out this relation, you know, all the other diagrams involving more than one irreducible part cancel, and it remains only this and this. So this relation contains the fact that all those chains of diagrams cancel when you try to compute the effective action from the contribution of the connected diagram, okay? And of course, this is consistent. You have to change signs when you use this general relation. Okay? Yes?
Also hold for higher point functions?
No, no. This is a relation for the two-point function. For some, because for instance, if you think about what is the relation for the four-point function, the connected four-point function. If you think about how it can be decomposed in terms of irreducible diagram, you can. This is its general form. This is external vertex. So it can be written as an. Some chain of irreducible. This has irreducible everywhere. Irreducible. You know. So the four-point connection function can be written as chains of irreducible two-point function, you know, crafted at one irreducible four-point function. You have no other way in phi 4. So, and this is, of course, the connected two-point function, and this is irreducible. So, the relation is that the connected four-point function is given by connected two-point function here, connected, and here it's irreducible two-point function. So in other words, this is, here you have 1 over the irreducible two-point function, here you have the irreducible four-point function, here you have the 1 over the irreducible two-point function, etc., etc. So the relation between the connected two-point function and the irreducible function is that it's a graph where you have four propagators, which are the connected two-point function, so the inverse of the irreducible two-point function, crafted at a vertex, which is the irreducible four-point function. So this is a relation, which of course generalize in a nice way the results that at leading order in perturbation theory, the two-point connected function is the ordinary propagator. Four ordinary propagator joining at the vertex. So the structure of the three-level perturbation theory, you know, is transported onto the general perturbation theory. Okay. Yes?
What's happening in that last diagram?
What's happening?
In that last diagram, what are the...
What?
In the very last diagram,
yes,
you drew, but I don't understand what the... Like, are those double lines or...?
Okay, let me be a bit more explicit. Okay, so this is a connected four-point function. The C is for connected. Okay, so this is a function, this is this function, gamma 4 of P1, P4, where P has a momentum. 3, 4. That's the general sum of all diagrams. So the point is that this object can be written as this object, where here I have the irreducible two-point function. Here I have those fat propagators. Where this irreducible four-point function here is just 1, 2, 3, 4. This is a connected, this is G. This is a connected. So this is not gamma four. This is the function G, which is a generating. So this is a connected four-point function. This is an irreducible four-point function, the sum of an irreducible diagram, like those one. And this propagator, fat propagator, where I have a momentum here, 1 and a momentum 2, so I have a momentum P flowing from here to here. This is G2 of P, and therefore this is 1 over gamma 2 of P from this theorem. So this diagrammatic relation means that this is simply 1 over gamma 2 of P1, 1 over gamma 2 of P2, 1 over gamma 2 of P3, 1 over gamma 2 of P4, times the irreducible four-point function of P1, P2, P3, P4, with, of course, the conservation of momenta, P1 plus P2 plus P3 plus P4 equals zero. So this diagrammatic relation between the connected two-point function and the irreducible four-point function, with those, you know, fat propagators representing just the full propagator of the series, the full two-point function of the series, therefore the inverse of the irreducible function, means that this connected two-point function is given by the irreducible four-point function, where you have four momenta incoming here, P1, P2, P3, and P4. These are those four terms, which are represented, this term corresponds to this, this term corresponds to this, this term corresponds to this. And this term corresponds to this, times this kernel, which is a function of the four momenta given by the sum of irreducible diagram. Okay? Is it clear? So this is so this is the analog the relation for the four-point function. So this relation here is represented by this object, which corresponds to this decomposition, this chain decomposition. And for the four-point function, this is the relation between the connected four-point function and the connected irreducible, the irreducible four-point function. Okay? Okay. Well, thanks for the question, because this means that I was a bit fast on Tuesday. Okay. So, well, it's okay. So it's important to understand this and to understand this. And in fact, this kind of diagrammatic representation is important if you think about the LSZ reduction formula that you will. Okay, so now let's go back to our renormalization. And now to the diagrams. Okay, so let me go back to renormalization. Okay. Okay. So to the amplitudes now. The physics is contained in what are those functions? Up to now, I've just discussed diagrammatic. Okay. So, of course, you see that there is a problem that we already discussed the problem here. This is that this amplitude represents the expectation value of the products of two fields at the same point. So this function that I called T of M, this function T of M, the amplitude of this connected diagram here, T of M, which is integral d dk over 2 pi to the power d 1 over k squared plus m squared, which corresponds to the expectation value of phi of 0 square in the theory is infinite as long as the dimension of space-time is larger or equal to 2, 3, 4. And that's because this integral is divergent at infinity when the momenta are large, because we have dk, so an integral over k momenta divided by the square of the momenta. So this is what's called an ultraviolet divergence, because it comes from high momenta. Okay, that's something we have discussed at length. Okay, so again, this diagram here, the amplitude of this diagram that we discussed already a bit. So if I have this moment, this diagram, which appears at two loop. So we have a momentum P1, a momentum P2, a momentum P3, a momentum P4, with P1 plus P2 equal plus P3 plus P4. Zero. What is the amplitude of this moment of this graph in Feynman in the momentum propagation? So this is this diagram, the amplitude of these diagrams. Let me call it B because it's a bubble. So B. So you can see easily that it's a function of P1 plus P2. So it's a function of P and of the mass. Let me denote P equal P1 plus P2, so that's the incoming momentum, total momentum, coming inside the graph, entering through this vertex. And it's given, well, what are the rules? Here I have a propagator, so let me assume that I have a momentum K flowing through this propagator by the rule of conservation of momenta,
I have
a momentum k plus p flowing through this. Remember, those are vectors, momenta. Okay. So the amplitude of this is the product of the propagator, k squared plus m squared, times 1 over p plus k squared plus m squared. And I integrate over all the possible momenta flowing. So I have an integral d dk over 2 pi to the power d. Remember, and k are d component vectors, momenta. Okay? And if you think about this integral, so it's a product. So now you have an integral over the d component of a momenta, and here a large momenta k, you have 1 over k to the 4. So this is divergent when the dimension of space-time is larger or equal to 4 instead of 2. So this is the famous problem of the ultraviolet high energy divergence. Okay, so this was my first blackboard. This was my second blackboard. So now we are going to discuss the significance of those divergences. What does it mean? Well, in fact, that's you know, the what's called the radiative corrections, the naive radiative corrections, which means the quantum corrections, because remember, to each loop is associated an H bar diagram, so they come from quantum effects. Are seemingly infinite, which is a problem that puzzled the physicists from the 30s to the 40s and beginning of 50s, while the problem was solved. And, well, first you have two ways to think about that. First, you have to think about the physics. You have to think, what are we really calculating? And if you are more theoretical or mathematically inclined, you have to say, okay, can we study carefully those divergences, those singularities, by changing the theory? So, first I'm going to say a word about regularization procedures. So, how can you change the quantum theory in order to study this problem carefully? So since these divergences come from high momenta or high energy, basically you have to change a bit the theory to make it have a better behavior at large. So this is called by ultraviolet regularization. You regularize the theory in order to control the divergence. So you can do that in many ways, and physicists and mathematicians have devised a lot of receipts, from crude to very clever. So first, we can use a lattice. That's what we discussed, this discretized space-time with a mesh. Let's call it A, very small. And then, of course, so it's a minimal distance. Minimal distance in the theory. So two points of space-time can be closer than the distance A or two time. Okay? And of course, then it means that since momenta are conjugate to momenta, that the momenta, you can define what's called lambda, which is basically, let's call it pi over A, is going to be a maximal energy or momentum. The momentum of the particles cannot be higher than lambda. And then, of course, if you assume that the momenta cannot be higher than some value, all those integrals become finite. And then you expect, for instance, that the 2 points will behave like lambda to some power. The 4-point function will be. Okay. So this is the first example. Well, a second example, which is very crude, is simply that replace, change the propagator so that the momenta are. So you can decide that change the propagator so that the contribution of momenta, which are larger than lambda, gives zero. So you can assume that the propagator is the usual propagator. So otherwise, it's p squared plus m squared if it's less than lambda. Okay. So it's called the sharp cutoff or sharp regulator. And that's the one we are going to use here because we are doing simple calculation. Well, you can work a bit more, so there are some cleaner way to change the propagator, but I don't think I'm going to describe them here. There is a generalization of that which is called the Poly-Villard regularization. And finally, there is some kind of wild regularization that I think you have met already in statistical mechanics, which is change the dimension of space-time. Space-time, d, and make it a complex non-integer or complex variable. And we are going to see an example that this makes sense. So this is called dimensional regularization. It's very useful. But mathematicians are still asking what it really means. So we go from something which makes sense in physics, and in addition, which is non-perturbative, because if you have been at the colloquium yesterday, you have seen beautiful application of this lattice regularization to do non-perturbative physics for strong interactions, to nice mathematical regularization, which are completely perturbative. So the question is whether we can make sense of something non-perturbative here is still a very open question. Okay, so we are mostly going to use this one here, because that's crude, but yes?
What's the difference between cutting off the momentum in the propagator itself and doing it in space-time? Like, it seems like the first two would be equivalent.
What do you mean by equivalent?
The first one, you would, I guess, just say that you're cutting off the bounds of integration, whereas the second one, you're making.
You mean the lattice?
Yeah.
Yeah, in fact, the lattice can be viewed as something like that. But you both change the domain of integration. Because if you have a lattice in momentum space, if you have a lattice in space, in momentum space, you have a Bridouin zone. So you integrate the component of the momenta, it's k1, k2, between this lambda, pi over a, minus pi over a, to pi over a. That's so. You truncate, but in addition, you change the momenta from 1 over let's say, the propagator from 1 over k squared plus m squared into the propagator on the lattice, which you have seen it in StatMech. It's just you have to be a bit careful, and I think if I'm not mistaken, this is 4 over a squared sum from mu equal 1 to d sine squared of k times a. Something like that. Plus m squared. And this, so this propagator, and that's k mu, I'm sorry, that's mu component. This is the propagator, so this is the continuous propagator, and that's the propagator on a lattice. And this propagator, of course, is periodic. So if you extend the Grignard zone, periodically you get the same propagator. So of course, this can be viewed as one particular version of changing the propagator. So you both change the integration domain and you change the propagator. So any regularization amounts to change something, change either the propagator or the domain where you integrate the propagator, or both. And dimensional regularization means that the propagator is still 1 over k squared, plus m squared, but the momentum now is as d component. So, and you consider that d is not necessarily an integer. Oh, well. It makes sense, but in a way which is a bit subtle. Okay. So this is the first way to think about the problem, is to think about regularization. The second and complementary way to think about the problem is to think about what are we calculating. Okay. And think about the two-point function. The two-point function, the irreducible two-point function, so this is the inverse of the connected two-point function. And you know, you have seen, I think, in QFT 1, that in momentum space, G2 of momentum, so if you represent it in terms of momentum, and I'm going to in terms of p squared, it has basically, it has somewhere a pole, or at least in energy, it has a pole, if you compute, it has a pole in energy at e squared is equal m squared, where m, the pole at e squared equal m squared, where m is called the effective mass or the self-energy of the particle. Because that's a mass that you measure in your experiments. If you take a particle, you measure it. So let me call it also the physical mass. Okay. And so in our calculation at first, at one loop, well, we are in Euclidean. So we are in an Euclidean regime. So p is, so it's when p squared equal minus the mass that characterizes the mass. So in the Euclidean regime, a pole in the two-point function corresponds to a zero for the reducible function. So the physical mass is this physical mass m is such that gamma 2 of p squared equals 0 at p squared plus m physical squared equals 0. Okay. So you look at the what's happening when p squared is negative. But remember, we are working in Euclidean regime. So when you go back to p squared is e squared plus momenta. So that's why. Plus. And therefore, you see that the physical mass squared here is not the parameter m squared, is m squared plus g over 2 times this diagram plus higher loop corrections. And the same thing will occur for the coupling constant, but I'm going to discuss that later. Okay? And so we are trying to pass integral methods or canonical quantization is a tool to construct a quantum theory. But we want to construct a quantum theory with a given physical mass, if you want to compare to some experiments or do statistical mechanics, etc. So you have to think of what you are doing always in terms of the physical quantities. And you see that this M in the action is not a physical quantity. It's something that you start from in order to construct a quantum theory. And therefore, you see, if you start from a theory with a mass m, and then take into account the quantum effects, the radiative correction, and try to construct a theory with a physical mass, which is given, then this you have to adjust this so that this plus this equals the physical mass. And this depends on the mass, too. You see? And so, when you change, and of course, this depends on the cutoff, too, because you have a cutoff. So, in fact, you have a relation that this is m squared plus g over 2 times this function, the amplitude of the tadpole that I call t, which is a function of the mass and of the cutoff. See, this is physical mass. Okay. And so this mass M, this M, we can call it the bare mass. The mass that you have to introduce in your theory when you start to construct it with a cutoff. And when you are interested in taking the continuum limit, space limit, namely the space where lambda goes to infinity or where the mesh of your lattice goes to zero, you have to adjust M, so that M physical is fixed, is what you want. So you have to remember that, for instance, what we are doing is perturbation theory constructed from some path integral. The path integral or the functional integral is defined by introducing cutoff. So we have to start from an action with some parameters. But what we are interested in is constructing a continuum limit. And so you see that because there are radiative corrections, you have to adjust or renormalize the parameter of your action in order to get what you are looking for. So this is a process of renormalization. This adjust, you know, tuning, fine-tuning mechanism, this is what they call renormalization. Yes?
In Minkowski's spacetime, is it proven that if you renormalize the Euclidean time theory, you are also renormalizing the Lorentzian time theory?
Yes, yes. There are theorems which ensures that it works, yes. I'm not going to do into the mathematical rigorous theory of that, but there are plenty of theorems starting from the 50s. People have both physicists and mathematicians, so I might go back to that later, but that's there are theorems first by Russian physicist Bogolyubov and Shcherbakov, and then some German and English mathematicians. So there are lots of theorems. So as far as we are looking with perturbation theory, we are on very safe ground. Okay. Well, I'm going a bit slowly, but that's not bad, I think. Okay. So this was the third. 1, 2, 3. Okay, so now I'm going to make this argument more precise by considering the massless five-four. So what is massless five-four theory? Okay, I'm interested in massless because, in fact, when you are interested in the high energy properties of a theory, all the mass parameters are irrelevant, so in fact, it's important for high energy. Important for high energy. Second, I've probably already mentioned, but you have seen that, the massless 5-4 theory has a very interesting property. It's scale invariant, so it has additional symmetry. Okay, but then we have to think about what it means for a theory to be massless. Massless means that the physical mass is zero, of course. Therefore, it means that the parameter M that we had here is non-zero. Okay. So, let's first discuss so if the theory was classical, remember there's an h bar term here. The physical mass is equal to the bare mass, because we just have to solve the classical equation of motion. So for the classical theory, this means that M equals zero only for the classical theory, because I have no radiative corrections. Okay. So, but now we have to consider what is this, this correction to that. So in that. So we start from M equals zero, then you compute the correction, and you see that T, this function called M here, in that case, this is given by integral d dk over 2 pi d 1 over k squared. So I'm interested in T when the mass is equal to zero, but when there is a cutoff. And I'm using this sharp cutoff. Okay? So massless, sharp cutoff, momentum regulator. So you can easily compute this integral because it's just, you can compute it in general. And I'm interested in what's happening in D equal 4. So this is d4k over 2 pi to the power d1 over k squared. So you can easily compute this integral. And you find that this is 1 over 4 pi squared times lambda squared. So it's indeed divergent. Okay? And it can only depend on lambda. You have no other parameter because I set the parameter m to be equal to 0. Okay? And then you see that the condition that the theory is massless is simply that then we need that m squared equal minus g divided by 2 times 1 over 4 pi squared lambda squared. So you need the mass to be equal to 0 at first order. And then you had something which is proportional to the coupling constant, and hence to h bar, but which is divergent with lambda. So this is called the counter term. This is called the one loop counter term. And it is with this precisely determined one loop counter term for the mass, that the physical theory is massless. You see? Okay? So, now, yes?
So now that you've made little non-zero, wouldn't you have to recalculate?
Of course. So little, but little m is just a parameter. M squared is a parameter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the physical mass is equal to the little m squared plus t that depends on m.
Ah, yes. So you are right. Yes. You are clever because I wanted to hide this difficulty. It's not a problem under the carpet. But then, of course, if you do that and you want to compute T of m, you have to compute what is T of m and of lambda when m is non-zero. Well, in fact, you can do the calculation. It's easy. And what you found is that this is 1 over 4 pi squared lambda squared. And then you have a mass correction. But the mass correction you obtain by expanding this 1 over k squared plus m squared. And if you do the calculation, I think that what you get is a factor minus 1 over 4 pi squared. And there is a log lambda. There is a log. I'm going to explain that later. Plus higher order term in m. So this is an expansion in m. I don't remember if it's lambda of lambda squared. At that stage, that's not entirely important, but it's lambda squared. Okay. But of course, then here the correction is in m is of order g. So you see that if we fixed m squared to be this, then the two-point function of p is p squared plus m squared, which is minus g over 2 times 1 over 4 pi squared lambda squared plus g over 2 times t of m of lambda, which is 1 over 4 pi squared lambda squared, minus 1 over 4 pi squared times m squared, which is minus g over 2 times 1 over 4 pi squared lambda squared. This is a mass term squared. Times, well, you have these terms, and then you have the log of lambda squared plus I order the term. And you see that this term that I've neglected here is of order, there is a g here, because it's a radiative correction, and that's the variation of the radiative correction when I include the variation. So this term that I've written is of order g squared. So it's important only at next order. And if you go to two-loop order, two loops, then you have to take it into account and work more carefully. But then there will be another counter term at two-loop over the g squared, which is going to cancel this lambda squared log lambda dangerous term. Okay? So as long as I stay at one loop, what I'm doing is correct. But you were right in raising the point. So I made an approximation, but that's enough at one loop. So that's enough. One loop order. And that's all what I'm doing. Okay? Okay, so okay. So now, so with this choice of counter term, we made the two-point function finite with this choice of counter term, of course. So this term cancels this one. So with this choice of counter term, let's write it explicitly. So with this choice, this counter term, the two-point function of my theory is just p squared. The counter term cancels the radiative correction to the mass. So it's p squared plus zero, let's say. That's really p squared. Then I have the one loop contribution, which is zero. Both those terms are zero. And then I have two-loop contribution that I've not calculated. So the theory is the two-point function is both finite and massless. Because the pole, no, the zero of the two-point function is at p squared equals zero. Okay. Okay, so now, of course, what we have to consider is what's happening for the four-point function. And that's where things become become interesting. But the first one functions and the coupling constant. Normalization. Okay? So now, what is a four-point function? Gamma four. Okay, I'm just writing it as a term of the, so that's the sum of the irreducible. We wrote it here. So so I have a momentum P1, P2, P3, P4. And this is just G, the contribution of the vertex, minus G over 2. And we have the sum of this diagram and this diagram, and those diagrams have been written here above. So this is basically FB of P1 plus P2, M and the cutoff. Now it should be cutoff, depending on the cutoff, plus B of P1 plus P3. The mass and the cutoff plus B of P1 plus P4, the mass and the cutoff. Okay? Where Pm lambda is an integral over d dk over 2 pi squared, 1 over k squared plus m squared. 1 over p plus k squared plus m squared. And I'm introducing a cutoff, so I infer that both k is less than lambda, and k plus p, the moment the length of the vector are less than lambda. Okay, so then that's everything is well defined. Okay. And now, of course, I am interested in the massless theory. So I have to replace M by this. But this is a correction of order G. And this term is already of order G. So I can set M equals 0, the classical mass, which is still 0, up to term of order g squared, as we did for the mass. So we can set inside B up to 2-loop correction. That's because we are interested in the massless theory. Yes?
That term with the B is not of order g squared.
Like, pardon?
The second term?
You are perfectly right. This was a typo of mine. It's of order g squared because it has two vertex, of course. Yeah, thank you very much. This is a term of order g, and that's the next order. So this means term of order g to the cube. Yeah, of course, I'm sorry. Okay. So in that case, what we have to compute is simply this, where you remove the hem squared. And as I said, this is divergent. This is divergent when d equals 4. And the divergence is logarithmic because you have a d4k over k. So at d equal 4, there is a divergence which is a log of lambda. You expect by just dimension count. Well, you can do the calculation because you can just think that this is dimensionless. Therefore, the divergence, you know, the divergence comes from large k. So k has to be much larger than p. For large k. And when k is large, you can forget about the mass, in any case, and you can forget about the p. So there is a coefficient here. Which is a pure number. It's a divergence of ddk over k4. Well, you compute it, that's an exercise, and what you find is that this is where is it? Again, there is a 1 over 4 pi squared, but I simply have to, yes, it's 1 over 4 pi squared. Well, that's just a calculation. And there is a log squared. Okay. And then, of course, which is a function of p. Because, of course, this is a function that depends on p. OK. So p of p, m equals 0, and lambda contains a divergence. Plus a finite term, d equal 4. Now, what is this finite term? In fact, we know this finite term when the theory is massless. Because this is a pure number. It's d4k over something that has the dimension of a momenta to the power of 4. So this is a number. It doesn't have any dimension in terms of momenta. But here we have a log lambda. And the log of something which has a dimension is meaningless, because I know what is log of 1, what I know what is log of 2, but I don't know what is log of 1 meter. I don't know what is log of, I don't know anything that I count with, which has some dimension. So, in fact, we need to have the log of something which is dimensionless. And the only things which is dimensionless in a function which is a function of the cutoff and the momentum is a ratio of 2. So in fact, b of p, m equals 0, and the cutoff is given by 1 over 4 pi squared log of lambda squared divided by the square of the momentum plus some constant, let me call it c, some number, and of course you may have terms that depends on lambda but which are convergent, plus terms that goes to zero when lambda goes to infinity. We neglect them. So there is some number which depends on the detail of regularization. And you have this. And that's a very important result, because this term here this is universal. If you think about a bit about it, for any regularization, you'll get the same log with the same coefficient. because changing regularization somehow amounts as changing a bit the definition of the cutoff, or changing a bit the normalization of the momenta. But changing, you know, changing lambda into two lambda change the number here, but doesn't change the leading coefficient. So this term is universal. It's independent of the regularization procedure. And that's very important. And this just comes from dimensional analysis. So it's not a subtle technical point. It's a basic point. It's because this integral is logarithmically divergent at large k. Okay. Good. So now what we have is just that the four-point function of the theory. So the four-point function of my theory is given by g minus g squared over 2 times b of p1 plus p2, which is 1 over 4 pi log of p1, I'm sorry, of log of lambda squared divided by p1 plus p2 squared. So it's 1 over pi squared. Plus the same thing with the function of p1 plus p3. This when 2 is replaced by p3, plus the same thing when p2 is replaced by p4. Well, plus some constant, which is an important. Plus terms for the g cube. So again, you see that there is a divergence. So the four-point function is not well defined. Okay. But again, you have to think of why are we computing the four-point function? That's because we want to compute, for instance, the scattering amplitudes in the theory. Two particles give two particles. And of course, the scattering amplitudes give you access to the strength of the interaction. So what we want to compute is a physical coupling constant. Okay, and then, okay, I don't think I need that anymore. And you have to think about how can we define a physical coupling constant in a theory? Well, we can define it by measurements. So for instance, we can define it by scattering process. So we can define by particle with energy E, some angles, you know, velocity variable, and we measure. So if it's a scattering process, two particles give two particles, well, the energy must be conserved. By rotation, the angle must be conserved, so it's an elastic scattering, so if you consider it on the elastic scattering, okay, and what you are measuring is the scattering amplitudes, let's say S of theta and of the energy, okay. And this can be computed in the 5-4 theory. I think you have computed this maybe in the QED, at one loop, maybe not. Did you? Anyway. Okay, and through the LSZ reduction formula, if you want to compute this theoretically, you have to, you need the four-point function. On shell, so LSZ reduction formula, and to get the four-point function on shell, you need the irreducible four-point function, which is the thing that we are trying to compute here. Okay, and the scattering amplitudes depends on the angle, and here we know. Easily, the dependence on the angle, because the angles are given by the scalar products of momenta, and it depends on the energy. Okay. So, let me take a definition, a possible definition. Of G physical, the coupling constant, the physical coupling constant. Well, in order to make things easy, I'm going to consider a reference point in momentum space where P1 plus P2. So the momentum of P1 plus P2 equal P1 plus P3 equal P1 plus P4. And I'm going to call this a reference mass or the reference mass point. So let me call it mu. This is a reference mass or energy point. Okay. I wrote it mu because it's a mass, in fact. Of course, I am in Euclidean space. So this is minus a square of an energy. So this is a reference point which would correspond to an imaginary energy. So you can work otherwise, but that's not important at that stage. Okay. And then you can say, okay, I can define the physical coupling constant, or what I'm going to call the renormalized coupling constant, as, by definition, the value of the four-point function at P1, P2, P3, P4, taken at this reference point. Okay? Mu. And then I've computed it by the theory. Yeah, I'm good enough. So this is G minus G squared over 2, 1 over 4 pi squared, times my log over here of lambda squared divided by mu squared. I have a factor of 3. Because there are three diagrams, and since I've taken a reference point in momentum today which is symmetric in the S, T, and U channels, because P1 plus P2 is the total momentum, is one of the channels of the Cartesian amplitudes, that's it. Well, I neglect the constant. I can adjust the coefficient so that it's a constant. Okay. Plus term of order GQ. This is one definition of G-physical, which refers to a choice of reference point in momentum space. And this condition is called renormalization. Condition, but it's just a choice of definition of your physical coupling constant. And basically, the amplitudes, the scattering amplitudes for the process at one loop at energy scales of order mu will be finite. That's because now, if we do this, and now compute a four-point function, P1, P2, P3, P4 for arbitrary P1, P2, P3, P4, given by this, but re-express it not in terms of G, but in terms of GR. Okay, G or G physical or G renormalized, or GR renormalized. Then the 4-point function contains a log of lambda of the cutoff. But when you express G in terms of G physical by inversing the relation, you have a log, and you can easily check that the log lambda cancels. It's finite because it's simply G physical or G renormalized minus G renormalized squared 1/4π². And the log lambda cancels, but here G physical depends on log lambda divided by mu. So it's easy to check that you get log of mu squared divided by P1 plus P2 squared, which is finite, plus a similar term where P2 is replaced by P3, plus a similar term where P2 is replaced by P4. Okay? And plus higher order terms. So, and this is finite. So this GR, which is what I call G physical, if you take it finite, you assume that you measure in your theory and you find some finite number, and you adjust your calculation, your theoretical calculation, to describe a theory where this G physical is finite, then you have to adjust G. Then all 4-point functions are finite. Okay. And I'm going to continue tomorrow, but then you can check that with those two renormalization. So this is a mass renormalization, the one I described before. Where is it? Yeah, this relation. Which is, it's behind. So you see, what you need is that if you need a mass renormalization, and a coupling constant renormalization, and here we have chosen a scheme of renormalization such that the physical mass is zero, because we are interested in masses theory. And we are interested in the fact that the coupling constant, the physical mass, is defined at renormalized at renormalization scale mu, then the two-point function is finite, the four-point function is finite, and you can check that the endpoint functions are also finite, addressing at one loop order. And that's basically because the endpoint function for the six-point function or the eight-point function in four dimensions are ultraviolet finite at one loop. And renormalizing the mass and the coupling constant can modify only those functions at two loops. So the COE is finite. And therefore, all what you compute can compute, for instance, all scattering amplitudes will be finite. So we have achieved to define a theory which is has no ultraviolet divergence in four dimensions at one loop when re-expressing it in terms of a physical mass here taken to be zero and the physical coupling constant. So we have achieved at one loop a normalization of the theory. So tomorrow, I'm going to discuss in more detail what is the physical meaning of the renormalization scale, which is something that you need to introduce in your theory. Because again, you need to introduce a counter term here, which has a log of lambda, but you have to introduce another scale. So you have to introduce a log of equals zero. So you need both physically to define, you know, your coupling constant by measuring what you are doing at a fixed energy scale, and mathematically because you need to have the logs, subtracts log of something which is dimensionless. So this is needed both for physics and for mathematics. Okay, and this is going to be, I'm going to discuss that later. And this is going to be lead to the concept of renormalization group in the sense of a perturbative quantum field theory. Okay. So, see you tomorrow. But if you have questions, don't. I'll be there in the afternoon. So.